In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
We hope you've been enjoying the History Extra podcast and all it has to offer. Summer is the perfect time to delve deeper into the things you love. So subscribe to BBC History Magazine for just £24.99 every six issues, saving 30% on the shop price. Plus, you will receive a book of your choice worth up to £30. Choose from Russia, Revolution and Civil War, 1917 to 1921 by Anthony Beaver, In Search of the Dark Ages by Michael Wood, signed edition, In Search of Mary Seacole, The Making of a Cultural Icon by Helen Rappaport, signed edition, or Persians, The Age of the Great Kings by Professor Lloyd Llewellyn Jones. To take advantage of this offer and for more information, visit www.buysubscriptions.com/summerreads2022. Offer ends on the 5th of August 2022. Offer only available to UK residents. Please visit website for terms and conditions.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. As the founder of the SAS, David Stirling has gone down as one of Britain's great Second World War heroes. But is Stirling's reputation as a daring military genius really deserved? In his revisionist new biography, The Phony Major, Special Forces historian Gavin Mortimer claims that it very much isn't. Based on extensive research into the SAS and Stirling's life, Mortimer argues that his legend is largely a myth, and that many of Stirling's achievements should have in fact been credited to others. He spoke to Rob Attar.
Gavin, as the title of your book, The Phony Major, suggests, this is a fairly revisionist account of the life of David Stirling. But before we come on to your take on him, what is the Stirling myth that you feel needs to be challenged?
The myth that needs to be challenged is that David Stirling was the sole founder and inspiration of the Special Air Service. And even more pertinently, that he was the great warrior who, the terror of the Nazis, the scourge of Rommel, which is very much the image portrayed in the book, The Phantom Major, that was published in 1958. And that was the beginning of a myth, because in the 10 years after the war, Stirling more or less went into a self-imposed exile in Southern Africa because he knew the truth. And as I explained, that fundamental to this story is Paddy Mayne, Blair Mayne, the second in command of the SAS, who Stirling was afraid of and was envious of.
Do you feel this myth came about a large part through the publication of The Phantom Major? And have subsequent books, TV programmes, have they built on the myth from The Phantom Major?
Yes, it was very much. Paddy Mayne, I'll refer to Paddy Mayne as Paddy Mayne throughout. His name was Blair Mayne, but he was a rugby international before the war. He was known really by everyone as Paddy Mayne. He was the epitome of the SAS warrior. And he was the man that Stirling wanted to be. And as I said, he was envious of the fact that Stirling was clumsy, uncoordinated, unathletic. He was immature. He was really everything that a good guerrilla fighter shouldn't be. Paddy Mayne, his one weakness was he liked a drink. He wasn't an alcoholic, but he was a binge drinker, I suppose, to use the modern vernacular. And unfortunately, in December 1955, age 40, he was killed in a car crash coming back from a night out. And that was the opportunity for Stirling to come back to the UK, to find a publisher, Virginia Cowles, who a couple of years previously had written a biography of Churchill, which Churchill was very pleased with and sent her a note. And Stirling, his one objective was to rewrite the history of the SAS with him as the warrior. And to do that, he had to diminish Paddy Mayne. So he turned Paddy Mayne into this dark, brooding, barely articulate, wild, undisciplined Irishman who only Stirling could control. Now, this was nonsense. But Blair Mayne, as I said, was a rugby international. He was also, he'd gone to Queen's, he'd studied law, and he had, just in the summer of 1939, he had joined one of Belfast's leading firm of solicitors. And he appeared in court as a young solicitor. He'd been voted on to the student council at Queen's. He was popular with his peers. So really, he was an academic, an athlete, not at all an articulate man, quite a shy man, but not the man portrayed in The Phantom Major. But of course, he was dead. And very importantly, the other founding officers of the SAS, Jock Lewis in particular, he was killed in the war. So there was no one to challenge Stirling's interpretation. And bear in mind, Stirling was a minor aristocrat. His mother was a friend of Queen Mary and of Stanley Baldwin, the former prime minister. One of his friends was Randolph Churchill, who actually came up with their moniker, the Phantom Major. The Phantom Major was a notorious case in the 20s of a First World War major who murdered his wife and then vanished. There was a big manhunt, and eventually he was washed up in the Thames. He'd committed suicide. Anyway, it was Randolph Churchill who came up in September 42 with a Phantom Major. This man, as I said, the scourge of the Nazis, who was so like a sort of a latter-day Scarlet Pimpernel. And that was, of course, that was not the reality. The reality was that Stirling was a very clumsy special forces officer. Most of his operations ended in, if not disaster, certainly in failure. Whereas Paddy Mayne, every time he went off what he would describe as good hunting, he would invariably destroy a dozen or 20 German planes, etc. So the Phantom Major, but of course, it also, very importantly, it was published by luck just at the moment that Britain needed a hero. Its morale was at rock bottom. We'd had the Suez Crisis barely 18 months before, and the empire was breaking up. The countries were demanding their independence. So Britain was in need of a hero, and along came the Phantom Major. Some of the reviews, more than one, mentioned the word Elizabethan, as in the buccaneers of yesteryear, the gallant, dashing Englishmen. And this was very much how it was portrayed in the press.
So your book obviously comes out some, you know, more than 60 years after Phantom Major did. In the intervening period, have other historians questioned Stirling and his role, or is this the first time this has happened?
No, this is the first time. And I myself, when I was a young man, my first book, Stirling's Men, was published nearly 20 years ago. And I very much added to the myth, the aura of Stirling. And Stirling died in 1990. And in the months before his death, he had worked on or collaborated with an author who wrote his biography, his authorised biography. That, again, consolidated what had been written in The Phantom Major. What Stirling, in effect, did was he switched places with Maine, because David Stirling, he was the one who was depressive and he was insecure and he was someone, I suppose, a rather needy figure. That was Stirling, but Stirling made Maine out to be that. And it was in effect an autobiography. Great chunks of it is just Stirling speaking. And there are other books, of course. Another pivotal moment in the Stirling myth, but also what I describe as today as the cult of the SAS, was the embassy siege in 1980. When some terrorists seized the Iranian embassy in Kensington in London, and there was a six-day standoff, and the terrorists murdered one of the 26 hostages, and Margaret Thatcher, then PM, sent in the SAS, and it was very dramatic. It was really one of the first instances of reality TV, because the world's press were camped outside and you saw these black-clad figures abseiling down this very elegant white facade. And they freed the hostages and killed five of terrorists. And it was a great success. And that really started the SAS brand, if you like. And of course, at the time, they weren't very well known. And Stirling really took advantage of this, and he wrote several forewords for books and again portrayed himself as the founder of the SAS and very much the man whose single-handedly his audacity, his courage had taken the SAS from this very small unit of 66 men to, by the end of the war, a brigade of 2,500 and then a regiment, 2-2 SAS, which is what we know the SAS today. So the last 10 years of his life really allowed him to embellish even more the myth of the Phantom Major.
Clearly his writings and his recollections aren't necessarily to be trusted in this regard. So what sources have you drawn upon to create your picture of Stirling and, you know, and of Maine and the SAS at this time?
I've interviewed about 60 or 70 veterans of the wartime SAS. And one of the things that did strike me was that they spoke with reverence of Paddy Maine. And they were in awe of Maine. And he took great care of his men and he would never risk their lives. There's a bit of a misconception that he was reckless. He wasn't. What I did find, and as I said, I was, when I first wrote about Stirling and the SAS 20 years ago, I was immature as a writer. But it did strike me that when they talked of Stirling, there was much less enthusiasm. And of course, that was because Stirling wasn't really part of the SAS, if I can put it that way. By which, what I mean is that the SAS was created in August 1941. He was captured in January 43. And in those 18 months, he spent most of his time in Cairo. His brother was the secretary at the British Embassy. And the SAS base was in a place called Kibrit, which was 80 miles east of Cairo. And it was Paddy Maine who was psychologically was the leader, the commanding officer of the SAS. Stirling was intimidated by Maine. He knew that he had the respect of the men. And so Stirling took himself out of the SAS, spent time with his brother, and he formed this clique of upper-class officers. So he had Randolph Churchill, who couldn't have been more unsuited to the SAS, but because he was a friend of Stirling's, and also, fair enough, he was a prime minister's son, and Stirling was very good at networking, and he was very good at selling his idea of the SAS because he was well connected. But you had Fitzroy McLean, the old Jellicoe, and several other, Carol Mather and Stephen Hastings, both later Tory MPs. So that's who he spent his time with. And so going back over these many, many hours of interviews with the veterans, I began to see that it was Mayne who they regarded as Mr. SAS, if I can put it like that. And then also I just began to reread the books and the operational reports, and things had always not quite seemed right. And I began to, the more I looked, and I really dug deep into the National Archives at Middle East files. So they weren't specifically SAS, but they were GHQ. And there was a lot of material there, which I found very critical of Stirling, his very shoddy idea of logistics. The Long Range Desert Group, who were the pioneers of British Special Forces in the Second World War, they became more and more exasperated with Stirling and just his rather cavalier approach. He treated it as a game. As I said, I used the word earlier, immature, and that I think really is a word that goes to the heart of Stirling, that he was someone who just, he was in love with the idea of being a Scarlet Pimpernel, but he wasn't suited to it physically or temperamentally. And it's only when I delved deep into the archives and then augmented that with my own interviews and other sources with the Long Range Desert Group that I began really to see the truth.
Could you tell us a little bit also about David Stirling's pre-war life, and how far was that part of the myth that grew up around him?
One of the things he did, and I discuss in the book, is that with the Phantom Major and then his biography, is he didn't just twist the facts of his Second World War experience, but he created this whole new person before and after the war. For a start, he wasn't born in Scotland. He was born in London. He never went to America with the idea of climbing Everest. He went there to ranch. He was sent to America in 1938 by his brother, Bill. We mentioned Bill in a minute, who was really the intellectual force of the SAS. But Bill, who was the eldest of six siblings, he and his mother, who was a real alpha female, a very impressive figure, and they were at their wit's end with David because he hadn't really been a success at Ampleforth School, where the brothers were sent in Yorkshire. He'd then gone up to Cambridge. He'd lasted just three terms at Cambridge. He then, his brother and his mother secured him a position at a architect's firm in Edinburgh. He quit that after a few months. And he really became, to use the jargon of a day, a lounge lizard in the 1930s. So they had a family friend who had a ranch in El Paso, and they sent him out there in 1938. Now, Stirling would have you believe in later life that he went there to train to climb Mount Everest, which was his one goal. He didn't at all. And there's letters and there's newspaper reports saying that I found a very funny diary piece in Tatler in early 1939, saying that the Honourable Mrs. Stirling had dispatched her son to El Paso in the hope that it would put some lead in his pencil, so to speak. So that myth only started in the Phantom Major. Similarly, in his biography published in 1992, he said that he was sent down from Cambridge because he was at Newmarket gambling the whole time. He wasn't. He was never, the three terms he was at Cambridge, they weren't continuous. He was there for a couple of terms and then he came back, but he was never there in the racing season. But he created this gambler, this mountaineer, this daredevil man, instead of the reality, which is he was a lounge lizard. And then the other thing that he created, this wasn't in the Phantom Major, this came out in the 1980s. He decided that that for 18 months in the 1930s, he'd gone to Paris to study under the great French painter André Haute. but that didn't work out. But it had a wonderful time on the left bank. And that, again, completely fictitious. The older he got, the more he weaved this complete web of untruths. But it was in his head, it was the man he wished he had been, which is why he stole Paddy Mayne's character and his exploits, because he was creating this completely fictitious figure, if you like. I mean, there's a term now that some people may have heard of, Walter Mitty, which is in the British military circles. Walter Mitty was a 1939 short story of this American man who's a daydreamer and he's always dreaming of his brave and gallant deeds that he's done. And in fact, he leads a very mundane and ordinary life. And that's come to be the nickname for people who claim to have been in the armed forces. It's usually something to do with the SAS. You know, there's an argument for saying David Stirling was the original Walter Mitty, because he was obviously in the SAS, but a lot of what he claimed in his life didn't actually happen.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Paddy Mayne kicked open the door and stood there for a couple of seconds as these startled German aircrew looked up from their having their supper or playing cards at Paddy Mayne, who said in his quiet Irish brogue, "Good evening," and then opened fire.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches, but there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
How did Stirling come to be involved in the Desert War then? I mean, that is true. He was there. He was in North Africa. How did that come about?
So I mentioned earlier Bill Stirling. So Bill, for me, I would describe Bill Stirling as the father of British Special Forces. He was a very discreet man. And of course, being the eldest of a family, he inherited, when Stirling's their father died in 1932, he inherited the estate in Keir, just close to Dunblane. And so a lot of land, a lot of money. And he was a very generous man, generous to his five siblings. But he joined SOE, or MIR, Military Intelligence Research, the forerunner of a Special Operations Executive, in beginning of 1940. And he went on a Special Operations mission to Norway in April 1940. And their submarine hit a surface mine en route to Norway. So the submarine came back to Rosyth for some repairs. And it was, he said, there were six of them. He invited his comrades to Kia just to rest and recuperate while they got another submarine. The mission actually was aborted. But it was Bill, while they were there, the six of them said, "Listen, this whole operation was actually pretty poorly planned. And let's be honest, we are very much naive and ignorant about what's needed for guerrilla warfare, but I think we should open a guerrilla warfare school." So Bill Stirling took this idea to the War Office, and it coincided with Winston Churchill's replacing Chamberlain in May 1940. The War Office saw the validity of this idea. And so in beginning of June 1940, in the northwest of Scotland, Bill Stirling opened the Special Training Centre, and his senior instructor was his cousin, Lord Lovett. He got from around Britain experts in demolitions, in map reading, in unarmed combat, in small arms shooting, 1924 British shooting gold medalist, for example. And through that school, throughout the summer of 1940, came hundreds of the newly formed commandos. And one of the people who came through it too was David Stirling. David Stirling wasn't one of the instructors. This is another myth that he's put out there, and people have believed that he was one of the senior instructors. David was in the Scots Guards. He was a dreadful guardsman. He was known as the Giant sloth because he was so lazy and he spent his time in London gambling and drinking. Bill came to his rescue, put him through his commando school, secured a place for him in number 8 commando, which was the posh commando unit, if I can put it like that, the guards commando. So a lot of aristocrats in there. He was right at home there. Evelyn Waugh, the novelist, was one of them. And Evelyn Waugh, who he remembered Sterling as someone who spent most of his time gambling or asleep in his bunk when they shipped out to the Middle East in January 1941. Bill Sterling was also sent to the Middle East with SOE in 1941. He very quickly became taken on by General Arthur Smith, who was the chief of the general staff to Wavell, who was a commander-in-chief Middle East. So Bill Sterling was right at the heart of power. And he saw in the summer of 1941, by which time, obviously, Rommel and the Afrika Korps had joined the Italians and the British having really defeated the Italians at the start of 1941. Now they were suddenly on the back foot. But he saw, through his previous experience and being at the heart of Middle East HQ, that an opportunity for a special forces unit, an airborne special forces unit, using parachute to drop into enemy-occupied Libya and attack airfields and etc. So David Sterling, who by this time the commandos in the Middle East had they were on the brink of being disbanded, he was inherently lazy, David Sterling. He needed to be pushed the whole time. And luckily he had his brother, Bill, to do that and to take him under his wing. So it was really Bill Sterling who came up with the idea of the SAS. And of course, he was in a position to hand this idea to Middle East HQ. Now, another great fallacy that David Sterling propagated was that he broke into GHQ. He climbed over the fence, or in another version, he climbed under the fence. And he got into preposterous. If you can imagine, this is the height of a war. They knew that Cairo was a hotbed with enemy agents. To think that someone could just climb over the fence, of course it was well guarded, but it's part of the myth of our Sterling, this daredevil. And anyway, the GHQ, they trusted Bill Sterling, and they authorized the raising of this small unit. Now, one of the evidence that the fact it was Bill Sterling's idea and that he really recruited the officers, that two of the officers recruited, we've mentioned Paddy Mayne. Paddy Mayne he was in number 11 Scottish Commando. He had left Scottish Commando. He'd been forced out because he'd confronted the CO, Geoffrey Keyes, and actually pushed him. They'd had an argument, and like a rugby handoff, he'd shoved him, which is a serious offence. But Geoffrey Keyes was very similar to David Sterling. He was this privileged, entitled, foppish, upper-class officer. And there's absolutely no way that Paddy Mayne, having escaped the clutches of one such officer, would then throw his lot in with David Sterling. David Sterling claimed that Paddy Mayne was in the glasshouse in a military prison, having struck his officer, which it wasn't true. He pushed him. He wasn't under arrest. And that he talked Paddy into joining the SAS. That's not true. It was Bill Sterling who recruited Paddy. So Bill Sterling was very much the brains of the SAS, both in how the idea came to be, the recognition that there was an opportunity for a very much smaller of them, commandos, which were troops of a couple of hundred, but for groups of 8-10 men to operate in as guerrilla saboteurs. But Bill was recalled to England in beginning of November 1941, 2 weeks before the inaugural SAS operation. And there's a fascinating letter that David wrote to his mother on the eve of that operation, the 15th of November, his 26th birthday. And he says in the letter how much he misses Bill. And he also says extraordinarily that he hasn't felt as homesick as he does now since he was a boy at Ampleforth College. So that just, I think, shows how, again, without Bill there as his emotional crutch, he was lost. And of course, that first SAS operation, they were advised by the 8th Army not to continue with it, to abort it, because the weather, it coincided with one of the fiercest tropical storms in the Western Desert for nearly about half a century. But I've no doubt that had Bill Sterling been in Cairo still, he would have said to David, abort it. David didn't. And of the 55 men who went on that operation, 34 were killed or captured.
But there were also a number of SAS raids in the time before David Sterling was captured that were more successful than that. So was that success generally in spite of Sterling, or did he play any role towards it?
No, it was in spite of Sterling, actually. You're quite right. So what happened after that, the disastrous first raid, the long-range desert group, whose speciality was reconnaissance, and they were brilliant navigators, they suggested to Sterling that it made sense if they taxied them to their target, because the Germans and the Italians really stayed to the coastal areas of the desert. They were, unlike the British, they were afraid of the interior. And the Long Range Desert Group was founded by Ralph Bagnold, who was in the 20s, a famous desert explorer. And they were really the masters of the desert. So what happened, the Long Range Desert Group, in their Chevrolet trucks, took the SAS to within 3 miles of the target airfield. And the SAS would then proceed on foot to the airfield. And then they would rendezvous with the Long Range Desert Group after they had carried out their sabotage. Now, the first operation involved Paddy Maine and David Sterling, and they split into two. Quite inexplicably, Sterling took just one other soldier with him, Jimmy Broth, whereas Maine took five, or six in total, Maine and five others. This was at Tamit Airfield. And they destroyed 24 aircraft, and they also saw a faint strip of light. You have to imagine it's pitch dark in these airfields. They weren't guarded because the Germans and Italians thought we're many miles behind lines. We have nothing to fear. And this light, it was the door of an aircrew's mess. And Paddy Maine kicked open the door and stood there for a couple of seconds as these startled German aircrew looked up from their having their supper or playing cards at Paddy Maine, who said in his quiet Irish brogue, good evening, and then opened fire. So they destroyed a mess full of aircrew and 24 enemy aircraft. David Sterling, who attacked Sirte with one other man, fell into a slit trench and they were chased off the airfield. So they destroyed nothing. 2 weeks later, they returned to the same airfields. This time, Paddy Maine and his five men destroyed 27 aircraft. Sterling this time wandered into a minefield. And when one of his men, Johnny Cooper, one of the men I interviewed, when they were aware that they'd strayed into a minefield, Johnny Cooper, in a whisper, said to the man in front of him, tell the boss we're in a minefield. So this was like Chinese whispers passed on. And David Sterling's reaction was to stand up and bellow at the top of his voice, what? What's that you say? And of course, the Italian guards heard him, and again, they were chased off the airfield. And in the meantime, the other important SAS officer, Bill Fraser, he and four men had blown up 37 aircraft on another airfield. So between them, Fraser and Maine had accounted for nearly 100 aircraft, and Sterling, none. So Sterling's response, envious of Maine, aware that Maine was, to all intents and purposes, the leader of the SAS, he appointed him the training officer in beginning of 1942, which is a bit like putting your leading goal scorer in a football team, putting him on the substitutes bench because he's scoring too many goals. Sterling went off on a couple of raids to a port, Borat, and he took with him a canoe, and thinking that they would paddle out and plant some mines on German shipping, it hadn't occurred to him that travelling over the desert terrain, very rocky, very bumpy for a couple of hundred miles, wasn't very good to these very flimsy canoes. And sure enough, when they arrived at their destination and they unloaded the canoe, it was just really sort of wood and torn canvas. And yet, 2 months later, he did exactly the same thing at Benghazi and the same result. And so, reluctantly, he brought Maine back, and Maine, his next raid, he destroyed 15 aircraft. And there was success in 1942, but it was Paddy Maine. And it took Stirling until the summer of, I think, June 1942 before he managed to destroy anything. And had it not been, as I say in the book, had it not been for Paddy Maine, one of those historical what-ifs, if Maine had been killed or captured in that first raid in November 1941, I've no doubt that the SAS would have disbanded, broken up, and returned to their units, and we would have heard no more of the SAS.
Despite all of Stirling's faults, did he have any positive qualities that you can identify? Did he make any positive contributions to the SAS?
He was an ideas man. His brother, Peter Stirling, who I mentioned was in the foreign offices in the British Embassy, he said, there was a quote from him, that David came up with very good ideas, but he needed to be controlled. And I think that's a very good way of putting it, as you'd expect from someone who knew him very well, the real Stirling. He was someone who saw the potential of the SAS. He was really a staff officer. He wasn't someone who should have been in the field. And he was charismatic. One of the explanations as to why Stirling was able to create the myth of a Phantom Major that endured for three quarters of a century was that he had the word that I discovered time and time again of officers using was, I fell under his spell. I was spellbound by him. He had this extraordinary charisma. He was about 6 foot four and a half, but he had this way of stooping and looking down. He had a very penetrating gaze. So he had this way of, and other men have said, he had this ability of talking, when he talked to you, to make you feel how much he depended on you and that you mustn't let him down and that how important you were. So he was very manipulative. But in terms of good qualities, he was physically brave. When early on in the SAS training, two recruits were killed when their parachutes didn't open and there was a problem with a static line. And they plummeted to their deaths in front of the men. And obviously morale was shattered. And yet they were back up in the RAF parachute. Instructor identified the problem very quickly and resolved it. And the next day they went back in the air, and it was Stirling who made the first jump. So he was, and to go on these missions, I feel in many ways I have some sympathy for Stirling, because I think he found himself very quickly out of his depth. He knew he was out of his depth. That's why he spent a lot of time with his brother and with Peter and with Bill Stirling for a few months. With three of them lived together. He forced himself into these situations and he did as well as he could. He wasn't a coward. He never ran away. And although one could say, of course, if he'd had real moral courage, he would have recognized that he was out of his depth and he would have perhaps relinquished his command or found a way. But as I write in the book, he was captured in January 1943. They didn't post any guards, and yet they'd passed through a German column only a few miles previously. A few weeks before, he'd been in hospital for a couple of weeks with conjunctivitis and very bad desert sores. He was physically and emotionally worn down, and I suspect that he wanted to be captured. That was his way out, that he was at the end of his tether. In the book, I quote a letter from Bill Stirling to his mother, saying that I think a prisoner of war camp may be the best thing for him, because I think he recognised that he was out of his depth. And so in that respect, I do have some admiration for him. And after, as I said, as soon as the war ended, he didn't stay in the army. Now, if he'd been such a great guerrilla genius, you'd have thought he'd have stayed on in some capacity, but he didn't. He didn't want the army. The army didn't particularly want him. if he hadn't written The Phantom Major, if he hadn't quite deliberately set out to diminish both his brother Bill and Paddy Mayne, I would have found him in a way a sympathetic figure. But the way he quite willfully diminished Bill and tarnished Paddy is his greatest sin.
That was Gavin Mortimer. His book, David Stirling, The Phony Major, The Life, Times and Truth About the Founder of the SAS, is out now, published by Constable. If you enjoyed this podcast, you might also like another of our recent episodes, where historian Jonathan Fennell delved into the Desert War of 1940 to 1943. You can find that by searching for Desert War in your podcast feeds. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.